the things that I hope readers take from this book is the idea that it's like things are rarely what they seem. If you like dig a little bit and turn over that rock and look around that corner, you might find something that you had no idea was there, but then ends up becoming like a really important piece of the story. So this kind of investigative detective work is what it feels like. You know, sometimes I wonder if we need to do more of that, you know, before we go right to, oh, here's the explanation for what's happening, if we haven't looked around all the corners and under all the rocks yet.
What if story is the answer to our crises of meaning and belonging, to our impulse to heal our lives and help others, to our desire and drive to leave this world better than we found it? Now, we love good stories. In fact, we're kind of obsessed, not just with the stories themselves, but with the stories behind the stories. Their oddly perfect timing, the healing process they provoke in their authors, and their capacity to catalyze individual and collective change. And we love exploring these with writers, thought leaders, entrepreneurs, healers, parents, and others. Tune in to hear these stories behind the stories and entertain with us the real possibility that whether you are a teller or a consumer, story is always offering or leading us to an answer. After 25 years of devotion to a therapeutic community she'd eventually owned and operated, it was time for Dr. Carlin Pleasance to close that chapter of her story. But what could top a quarter century of witnessing the power of a treatment center founded on the Lakota principles of kinship, shared responsibility, and giving back? Well, when the inspiration for Feathers from the Fire struck, Dr. Carlin Pleasance was swept up and away by the synchronicities that began to unfold through her own writing and research, opening up a new path for her to shift paradigms and rewrite cultural narratives about mental health, healing, and the infinite possibilities available when we believe there is always more to the story. Get ready to discover the necessity of curiosity in the world of mental health in this episode. All right, welcome to Sips of Story Insanity, where we talk about the stories behind the stories with authors, speakers, thought leaders, healers, parents, and more. A few of my partners here at Save by Story, my son, Aaron.
Hello.
My sister, Alyssa.
Hello.
And clients turned friends turned partners, Teddy.
Hi, y'all.
And Lori.
Hey, everyone.
And Carlin.
Hello.
Are here to help me make sure we get the most delicious sips of story insanity out of this experience. And today we get to interview one of our very own partners. As a clinical psychologist, international speaker and trainer, and leading clinical advisor, Dr. Carlin Pleasance is wholeheartedly committed to shifting paradigms and rewriting cultural narratives about mental health, healing, and the infinite possibilities available when we believe there is always more to the story. For 25 years, Dr. Pleasance has helped create thriving therapeutic environments that have supported thousands of individuals and their families in successfully building a life of self-management, health, and independence beyond the bounds of psychiatric diagnosis. She's considered one of the nation's authorities on working with complex mental illness at the individual, sibling, and whole family levels, and speaks on topics related to mental illness in families, the arc and structure of lasting change, and the importance of healing at greater systemic levels. With a clinical lens grounded in attachment theory and certifications in clinical trauma treatment, as well as in union psychotherapy, she prefers to walk in the world of intergenerational transmission of stories, the tales, experiences, beliefs, and traditions passed along through systems. And Carlin is getting ready to release her very first novel, which is like all about all of this amazing stuff in your bio. I'm so excited to dig in with you today. But let's start with Where were you? For me, I find for a lot of people, this isn't something that just like builds over time. It's usually like a flash of experience or inspiration that happens when we think about writing the book. So what was that initial inspiration like, and how much of the story and message that people are going to get when they order the book started there, was already present?
Well, it definitely was not a slow build. It was like a crash landing in my head. I was literally driving to work and had been a little bit lost in trying to find my way. We'd just sold our business. I went from working, a gazillion hours and managing all these different projects to like just having a lot more time on my hands, and my roles at the facility were very different. So I had been, I'd been kind of lost. Like, I don't know, what do I want to do next? I know I'm not done, but and like really feeling a need for some inspiration. And I was like just literally driving to work, like listening to a podcast or something. And it was like, not only did the idea just like drop into my head, but it's almost like I heard it and saw it. Like, oh, how about a book? And how about it be about a family's pilgrimage or their journey through, to like find answers and a solution for mental illness, and then all of the trappings that would come with such a journey. And it was so crystal clear that I immediately felt this like no, like this don't, no. But I kind of knew it, right? Like I had that feeling like no. So I got to the office and I went into my friend Melissa's office because I'm like, I have to tell somebody because I think I will talk myself out of this. And I said, I just had this thing happen. And I told her, and it was like I was just saying the most natural thing in the world. And she went, oh, of course you're gonna write a book. Like, what do you mean? She's like, you're not done. And it was like that was one of the thoughts I had was that I wasn't done. So, just the synchronicity of even the very first moment was like I felt it. It was something that felt like too true and too real to not pay attention to. So what people will see is a version, a variation of that initial idea. It's still very much a journey about a family trying to figure out their way through, uncertainty and not knowing and stigma and other people's opinions and all of these kind of things. But how it showed up was just a little bit different in terms of the characters and location and things like that.
Yeah. So usually what comes with that inspiration is, I've always used the butterfly metaphor, right? Like this magic egg drops in, and then all of a sudden it's like a hungry caterpillar. It's almost like you a creative process takes over and you're trying to keep up with it. Is that kind of what happened with you too?
It's totally what happened. So I had this idea, and part of the inspiration was, well, I've seen in at this time it was about a little over 20 years, about 20 years I'd been in the system. I'm like, what? I mean, I've seen these journeys, 1,000 times over of people really trying to navigate and make their way. So it's not like it was a novel idea, but the idea that it would be a fictional story was like, oh, that's interesting, instead of it being something kind of academic or textbooky. But once it like caught me, I could not keep up with my brain. I mean, I was like, I'm a fast typer, and I would like just almost not be able to keep up thinking about it all the time. It was like the creativity juices were just like so intensely flowing. And what was interesting about that time is I really liked it because, I mean, I like doing research anyway. I liked being in school and doing research papers. I like kind of digging into something and learning more about it. But there were so many things So I would just read and read and find little connections and like, oh, I didn't know about this thing and go over there and go down that rabbit hole. And it was just this kind of constant learning and being inspired as I was learning. But it was voracious. I mean, I was dreaming about it. I would wake up in the middle of the night with like some idea and have to write it down. And I remember sitting across my desk from my husband one day and trying to like convey what was happening. And you could tell he was like, okay, like he didn't get it really, you know? But at one point I said, I feel a little, like a little tiny crazy right now. Like I cannot keep up, but I like it, right? There was something very engaging about it. So it was very hungry in the beginning. And I mean, I could be anywhere if a thought came. It didn't matter if it was on the back of a napkin, like it didn't matter. But there definitely was a point where that kind of like slowed down and stopped. And then it was like a whole new chapter had to start because it was like like I was downloading and then I was like done, like download complete. And just sitting there, like, well, now what do I do? I guess I got all my ideas out, but now what?
I love that. Every time I read about one of your main characters in the story who's like got that very deep connection, like that easy, just kind of knows things, just kind of understands the next thing that needs to be. Like, I always think that mirrors to me that part of you that's just like seen all of the connections and, getting really excited about all of that synchronicity that's showing up.
And I guess in some ways it's really related to one of the things that I hope readers take from this book is the idea that it's like things are rarely what they seem. If you like dig a little bit and turn over that rock and look around that corner, you might find something that you had no idea was there, but then ends up becoming like a really important piece of the story. So this kind of investigative detective work is what it feels like some of the time. And in my field, in the field of, psychiatry and psychology, there, sometimes I wonder if we need to do more of that, before we go right to, oh, here's the explanation for what's happening, if we haven't looked around all the corners and under all the rocks yet.
Yeah, like all of the little check boxes, symptom one, symptom two, like why isn't there another possibility down here? I think that's one of the most important parts of this novel and this message that you're putting out there is that piece of really being willing to sit with the normal response that we would get in the world for all this, and then be able to ask, like, but what if? But what if? And to trust the gut, to a large degree. So I also love this element of, when I saw the original manuscript that you downloaded, I was so excited about all of the different themes and how these things that I never would have imagined could fit together did. And one of those elements was the Native American philosophy that the cultural underpinning that kind of floats through this book on the shoulders of one of the main characters. And I would love for you to share a little bit about like why that? Why did that get included? Why was it an important element to this story for you?
Sure. Well, it was central to the story because I feel to me it's a central part of my life and who I am. The mini backstory is my first kind of real clinical job was at a small therapeutic community treatment center that had been kind of built and founded by a woman who was part Native American, and through her own experiences in the field had kind of found her own path and recovery through some Native American principles and philosophy. So she brought that back and opened a treatment center that was really rooted in specifically Lakota, Sioux Lakota traditions that have a lot to do with community and kinship and the idea that we're all in this together, that we as a group, a tribe, a community, whatever you want to call it, a system, will thrive optimally if we're all like taking responsibility for the greater whole and we're all working together toward that greater good, rather than just be on our own little like individual islands. And so there was this kind of notion I got exposed to early on that it was very flattened hierarchy, right? So it wasn't like, oh, here's the doctors, here's the nurses, here's the this, here's the patients. Everybody was considered the same and held equal value to whatever they were going to be bringing to the greater system. So this was such a unique and to me kind of unheard of notion, having been like brought up academically in traditional like Western medicine models. So first it was just unique and unusual, and I didn't know about any of these things. But then what I saw is people really getting better through these philosophies. They really weren't, you know, not that like a medication or a certain kind of therapeutic support wasn't helpful. It was. But the thing that really enabled people to like reclaim their identities and start thinking about living a life that's not just about managing an illness and having friends and having goals and having dreams really came out of being part of this community that shared that belief. And the, you know, it's kind of transposed against more traditional models where, you know, you are the patient and you have something wrong. So you come to me, and me as the doctor is going to do something for you or give you something. And then you go home and hopefully you're better. Right? This was like upside down. So that was like the very beginning of this notion of a kind of a culture, a tradition, a philosophy that it existed that seemed to work really, really well, but we had kind of strayed a lot from it. So that was the like initial my exposure that then became kind of a way I chose to live my life, not just at work, but in general. The other piece, which this showed up a little bit later as I got just more interested and more intrigued and would read more things about some of these philosophies and traditions, is that in some of the cultures, at least the ones I was reading about, for example, somebody having visions, seeing things, hearing things, having bodily sensations that other people were not experiencing, were considered gifts, like something special is happening. And we have to listen. And what is this voice telling you? What is this vision that came to you? What did it say? How do you feel about it? So it was kind of esteemed and seen as something like, oh, let's listen. What's available here? Where if, you know, if we think about our current system, you know, if somebody walk in and saying, I'm hearing voices, things are talking to me when I'm outside, and sometimes I see things that other people don't see, like we know where we go with this. This person has psychosis, they might have schizophrenia, maybe they have brain damage, they could be intoxicated. You know, we can go down the list, but our system does not go to, ooh, tell me more. Right? So learning like, oh, that isn't that interesting. This was not stigmatized nor pathologized, but revered. And then what were some of the things that became available through listening and being curious versus closing that down and like pretending it's not happening?
Yeah. Yeah. And one of the things, I don't know about Lakota, but one of the things that I've heard in this conversation before is that a lot of those visions and those extra sensory things were actually the cue for the spiritual elder of the tribe to maybe see the next medicine man who would take over, who had to, you know, have that library of their story and their traditions and their rituals kind of, oh, that's the one I'm supposed to download to because they're the ones who have access. And so to think about that, that even, you know, to lean in and also like maybe there's something to this potential, like there's something for everybody that's supposed to come out of this. It's not just something that's coming through for that person, but potentially for a whole tribe or, yeah, the bigger community.
Well, that's, you know, that was one of the pieces that was in the treatment center I was working for, where the keeping everything to yourself, the like, oh no, this is, people don't want to hear this, or I'm embarrassed, I'm ashamed, this is scary, people are going to judge me, right? All the things. So this idea that, oh, just go, you know, take it to your therapist. That's where you can talk. This, again, this was upside down. It was the opposite. Like, nope, it was all in group. And there was an encouragement of helping people work through that. Like, I don't want to say I'm embarrassed, or, oh, and I've shared this in the past. Like, you know, people didn't like me, whatever. But this idea of, no, you bring it to the group, because there are going to be people in this group who have maybe more wisdom, or they've been doing this a lot longer, or they've gone through their own processes, and they're going to help you kind of decipher or interpret this experience you're having in a way that is not wrong or bad or ill, but just help you kind of figure out what this means for you in your life. So that was also in the treatment center philosophy, is this, you bring it to the group, you bring it to the elders, you bring it to your peers who will help you kind of figure out what this means for you in your life and then what you want to do with it. And very untraditional in our standard.
Definitely not a fit for a culture that doesn't even really like to admit that we're human and we don't know sometimes. I mean, like, you know, why, you know, leaders can't be faulted. Parents have to be heroes and have it all together all the time. Like,
yeah. Oh, that was one of my earliest lessons. Again, I was green. You know, I didn't have a lot of experience yet. I had a lot of book knowledge, but not a lot of people knowledge. And so here I am, this community, it's been around for a long time. At the time, the clients, many of the clients were like older than I was. So I was like, oh my God, what am I going to say? Right. And my, you know, the people who'd been there for a long time before I got there said, oh, just say you don't know. Like if somebody asks you a question, just say, oh, you know, I don't know. And to me, in my mind, that was like the worst answer ever to give somebody. I'm supposed to be the therapist, right? I'm supposed to be the one. And they're like, well, but you're not. So just say, if you don't know, just say you don't know and ask somebody else in the group. In my mind, I'm like, you mean one of the other clients? Yes. But I mean, this is foreign. This is not how our current educational system around counseling and therapy, it does not involve this. So, you know, I'm looking like, oh, okay. And I remember the first time that something had happened and there was a client that was having a hard time and a little bit like kind of inconsolable. And in my mind, I'm like, oh my God, here we go. I don't know what to do. Like, I literally don't know what to do. So I was like, okay. So I turned to somebody who I knew, a client who I knew had been around for a while. And I said, so what do you guys usually do right about now in these groups when this happens? And she was just like, oh, we do this. And like, there they went. So like, they did the intervention. They contained the person who was having a hard time. I just kind of sat and watched this unfold. But I remember that it, like, oh, this, you know what? I actually don't have a lot of answers and I don't need to have a lot of answers. You know who has the answers? This group. And if we can shift the authority, the power, the responsibility, whatever, the wisdom of the group will provide the solution, the answer, the intervention. I just have to be a member of this group. But it's so foreign. But having this, like these kind of early, getting to be trained up in this early, I mean, it absolutely changed the whole trajectory of, you know, where I ended up going professionally, but also personally.
Yeah. Well, and I can imagine that someone who had their first part of their career heavily steeped in the more traditional route would probably have a really hard time going into.
I remember being like, where am I? What is happening here? Like, it just seemed like it, right? It seemed like odd and kind of weird. And like, is this even responsible? This feels weird. There was a wisdom there. Had been, you know, speaking of what you were saying earlier about like the intergenerational transmission. By the time I started working there, the program had already been open for 18 years. It opened in 1979. I got there in 97. And so like it, I mean, that now that feels like a little bit of time because I was there for 25 years, but there was a culture that was like upheld. Even when members would come and go, new people would come, people would graduate and leave. There was this like ethos of the place that this is what we did. So very interesting. But it set so much of this in motion.
Yeah. Well, and then at what point, because the other part, the really fascinating element that has this like mystical, it's kind of that mystical thread through the book, is the community in Geel that you learned about. So like at what point in your professional journey did that cross your path? Was that early on too?
It was early, but really just like a basic, like one of my colleagues told me about it. Oh, you should look up the story of this place in Belgium that it's kind of like considered the original therapeutic community. You know, they, instead of housing people in like hospitals and whatnot, they had people go into other homes. And they found that those folks actually got better compared to the ones that were housed in the facilities. So like I learned early kind of that little, just like in an eggshell. I'm like, oh, I mean, that's interesting. And then fast forward several years, I was doing some talks on working with siblings in particular, like when there's siblings who have a brother or sister who had or have a mental illness and what their experience was like in the family. And I came across some research done by siblings that said, like one of our biggest pieces of advice for family, like parents, but also treatment professionals is just treat everybody the same. Like it's okay that my sister had bipolar disorder, my brother had schizophrenia. I mean, I get there's going to need to be grace at times for things, but like we should all be held to the same. Like we should all have our own chores. And if I have to make my bed, he should have to make his bed. And there was this notion of don't treat us all differently. Treat us the same and then give grace where some special things might be needed. Because the sense was by I had to do this, but he only got to do this, like this kind of separation. So that got me thinking about like, oh, you know, I remember that story about this place in Belgium. So I went and like dove in and tried to find as much as I could. And that was one of the things that they attribute the progress and the growth to was when they call them boarders or guests. They don't call them patients, clients, anything label-y. Would be so it was almost like foster care. Like the authorities at the time, which was the church, would go to a house, like a farmstead in the town and say, so we have somebody. And they would intentionally not tell them anything about like a label, what their problems were. They would just say, he's here. So our only advice, like your directive is treat them the same as everybody else. Same thing, same as your other kids, same as anybody else who's living in your house. No special treatment. contributes the same way everybody else does. And that was one of the elements that later over time was identified as like, that's one of the magical pieces here. Don't treat them any different. Don't put a label. Don't call them a different name. Don't, you know, say, oh, these kids are going to do this, but you can't because of this. So there was this like full integration, not only into that household, but into the community at large, where there was just this like, everyone's the same. And so that's partly how, like, so then it, to me, that was that aligned with the stuff that siblings were saying, right? So I just started getting a little bit more curious about like, okay, how did they pull this off? We're talking like the 1300s, like, how did this happen? And how is this still happening today? Which it is, by the way, very, very small scale compared to in the past. But it's still, that is still a tradition practiced in that town of no labels, no special treatment. And so it even relates to a lot of the theory around with positive psychology and authoritative parenting, right? This idea of if your kid or somebody you know is struggling, don't come in and just like do the thing for them, because that's actually not going to help any, it's not going to help them. But be a cheerleader, like sit on the sidelines, even if you give a little bit of directive, like, oh, no, not quite like that, try it like this, but don't do for, empower the person to do things for themselves. So it all fit into this. So when I read about this town and the legend and how this entire philosophy was founded on this one kind of little known saint who lived, you know, 700 years even before that, I just thought it was fascinating, a fascinating piece of legend and lore of, you know, back then, things, you know, things weren't really written. This was all passed orally. So who knows what got lost in translation? Maybe this is just a big old legend that got made up over years, you know, but the idea that, well, even if it was, the idea of this young girl who escaped madness in her own family with the desire to like create a space for people who are ill to come and get better inspired this thing that is still happening. You know, I just found it like really, really fascinating and like inspiring, right? That this can work. This can work if there, and if there's enough support in a community to make it work.
So did you know from the very beginning that all of those pieces would be part of this novel?
Like, I mean,
did you see the threads?
No, like you were saying, there would have been a time that I would not have seen any of these connected at all. But as I would read more about this, I'd be like, oh, that reminds me of, oh, we actually already do this at the program. That's interesting. And so it started making almost like a little web, right? Of like, I've never put together before. And then, so when, you know, when the idea came to write this book, it was following those little threads that then led me to like, oh my gosh, I had no idea this was connected too. And so it built like this little fabric, you know, that ended up being the thread through the entire book is this idea of connections and interconnectedness and things like story behind the story. On the surface, it may look like this has nothing to do with it, but you know what, deep down, it really does.
Yeah. And I want to say, wasn't there even some type of weird synchronicity that happened with where you decided to place, like the setting that you chose for this? How did that, I know we don't want to give away too much in relationship to the story, but is there anything that you want to say about that, how that happened?
I don't want to say too much because this shows up in the book. But the short version is I was trying to, I'd already like my character family was already kind of in play, But I was trying to figure out, like, where do they live? Like, where are they from? Where do they live? And just was literally doing research, and somehow I got into like the history of how mental health treatment facilities like throughout time. And that wasn't super foreign to me. That was part of going to school and things like that. But I started looking and I found just this like intro, it was almost like a tidbit of, oh my God, this is like a fun fact about this one hospital that was one of the first state hospitals in the history of the United States, that was commissioned to be built. And the person who, like the superintendent, I think is what they were called back then, rather than run it like a traditional psych hospital, and we're talking like in the late 1800s. So we know what psych hospitals, I mean, they were asylums. They were asylums, and people were chained in rooms and medicated and, all kinds of horrific things that we know about, were happening back then. Well, this guy was like, no, well, we can bring all the people with mental illness here. And you know what? They're going to work. They're going to live in cottages with the other patients, like with peers. They're all going to have jobs because it takes a lot of labor to run a facility. So some people will help with cooking, some people will help with the farming, some people will help whatever. And this is going to be a community. The patients went by like their first names. The doctors went by their first names. And so when I was reading this, I'm like, oh my gosh, it's like a therapeutic community in like 1890 something, when this was not the format, right? This was like bedlam was going on at this time. So here's this guy. And apparently it was so successful, because he did not want to run it like an institution, that people would come and like visit the grounds because they were really pretty. He had all these gardens and the patients were working the gardens. So I was like, oh, here we go. This is where they're from. Like this just, I mean, they're not in the institution, but I just love this, right? I love that this is, I like this town. We're going to do this. So as I keep reading about this institution that is no longer there now, but it was up until like 2000 something. They had a shrine built inside the facility, like in the chapel, to bring like comfort for the patients who chose to go to chapel for guidance and support. And the saint that they picked to represent this facility was the one from Jill, Belgium. And I'm like, oh, you cannot make this up. You've got to be kidding me. So those little things, right, of like, what are the chances? I could have read about any facility, any hospital. So to me, that was just another like, you know what? There is something that connects all these places and people and philosophies. So that's where they're from. Old Ohio.
As a writer and tell a storyteller, I was so fascinated because I cannot imagine. And that was like one of the things, like, how did she do this? All these threads and pieces, and like I write little short stories. I just like to do all that. I was like, I was so fascinated with that, and I was going to ask you about that. But what you're telling me is that the book, basically just kind of said, here I am, I want to be written, and I choose you. And here's all this. That's so cool because I don't know how really it's really fascinating. Really fascinating. All the strings and pieces and is unbelievable.
And you're right, Teddy. Like they were already there. That's the thing. Like I didn't create any of these or, force two strings to be together. They were already there. It was literally just finding them. And that again, it not that I didn't intend any of it to go this way. Like you said, it kind of I got picked. And so I wrote the story that was waiting to be written. But it was like Gosh, you know, if you just start, if you stop at the surface description of this, you know, the Eastern Ohio insane asylum, then, you know, we know what kind of images that brings up of what we know. Like, if you had just stopped there, then that's it. I just, you know, you move on to the next topic. But to dig and find the rest of the story and to like look under a little rock or around a corner, all this stuff was taking place that then sparked, right, the inspiration for all these other things. So it's kind of, it in unintentionally became part of the message of the story, which is basically not, don't just settle for what's on paper or the what the cover looks like. Dig in there because you're going to find some things that may, you know, have a lot of like a lot of bearing on your experience. So, yeah, that was so fun to have those little experiences. Big experience.
Almost feels like I feel chills. It almost feels like a spiritual experience. You know, like I don't know how else to describe it because that is fascinating. Really fascinating.
There were times when it felt like that. Like there's one, I'm not going to say it because it's in the book and it'll be a giveaway, but there's another little, there's something in the book that I had no idea. I'm just reading along, doing some research. And I came across a bit of a story that seemed so disconnected from a piece of story I had like in my mind made up. And I remember where I was sitting in the living room and I just was like, is this happening? Is this literally happening? Is somebody playing a joke on me right now? Like it was so unbelievable, but I kept reading and reading. And then of course I like go onto the internet to like find out if this is even true. I'm like, oh my gosh. Some like, this wasn't even my idea. I thought it was my idea, but it wasn't my idea. So yeah, I had several, you know, a number of experiences like that, and most of them have showed up in are in the book somewhere.
So who, you know, again, it's one of these funny little things where like it is a mystery. The book is written so that the messages unfold through the story in a particular way, not just to create a good story, but really to help the reader go on the journey and and unpack their own possibilities, right? Mm-hmm. Like start turning over the rocks and seeing like, I wonder if, oh, this seems like an important element in this process of really trying to get to what's at the bottom of this story. I'm gonna think about that. I'm gonna take that into my life. So when you think about who you really want to read this book, maybe thinking about people that you've worked with, you know, 10, 20 years ago, who is that person walking through a bookstore or up late at night on the internet trying to find an answer to their situation? Like, who is that for you? Who did you imagine while reading the book?
You know, it's the first thing that came to my mind, even in the very beginning, was thinking about all the parents I have worked with over the years who come in like scared and defeated and like no hope, you know, and maybe they came to my facility after, you know, they've been in six other ones that haven't worked. And this like kind of dejected, like we're here because we, you know what, we don't know what else to do. Doesn't seem like anything works. Like this, it was in the beginning, it was them. It was like, okay. And there still could be more. There's, you know, again, stones that haven't been turned over yet, or corners that we haven't peeked around, or like, don't give up hope. So in the beginning, it was very much about like parents or even like the person who has the diagnosis, who's been diagnosed, who's just like, I feel so helpless, but you know what? I'm not ready to give up. There's got to be something more. This can't be it. So I think it's the folks who are on that, like that precipice, right? Of, I've had all these experiences. They haven't been great. I don't feel great about prognosis and what the future, but like, I'm just not ready to throw in the towel. There has got to be something else. So those folks. And then as the book unfolded, then I was thinking, well, but you know, there are a lot of people like therapists, clinicians, psychiatrists, GPs, whatever, who see, right? Who see people who are in that place. And it could, maybe it would help them too, right? Like one of the things that I can't even tell you how grateful I feel, is spending all that time at the program. You know, I developed a lot of relationships with other people who came to work there over the years. In fact, last night I went out to dinner with three of like, I would consider my best friends, who all at one time were like an employee of mine, who came up through the system. And these folks are out there now, because our program isn't, the one that we had in San Diego isn't there anymore. But they're out there in their private practices and working for other programs and doing their own thing. But they have this. They have this. I get that the book says you have these 14 symptoms and that means you have this diagnosis. Nope. Like, congratulations. Let's see what else is in there. They already have that. So there's a part of me, it's like, well, maybe that can be one of the things that happens, is providers or people just in helping professions who, I don't know, maybe sometimes wonder if just the, you know, going straight to the book of symptoms is the only way to go. Can you consider the possibility that maybe there's some other story at play here, or there's something else going on? So like, my wish is that it would be that this book might find its way into the hands of people who are serving in a way that opens doors versus closes them down. So that's also kind of an audience. And then I think just general, like, I like story, like I've always been a big reader. I like stories that bring in like, oh, I had no idea, or, oh, I never thought about it like that. Isn't that interesting? That kind of spark some new information or new thought about something that like I thought I knew about. So even folks who may not be connected at all to the field, mental health or treatment or anything like that, I think there's also a lot to gain here for yourself.
Yeah. And I've met a lot of therapists and doctors and chiropractors who, you know, very well trained in the protocol, and this is how you approach it. And then you hear them get to a point in their career where they're like, oh, gotta be another possibility here. Or they start to put pieces together for themselves. Like one of my chiropractor friends left chiropractic because he was like, I just keep putting people's bones back together. When I'm listening to them on the table and they're telling me what's really driving all of the sickness in their body, they're talking about this relationship that's pulling them in all of the directions. And he's like, and what does their body look like? It's being pulled and all of, and so for him, it was like wearing him out and making him tired. Like, what other way, how could I get under there and come at it from a different angle so that whatever it is that's actually driving this gets addressed, instead of just, you know, put back together for 2 weeks and then poof, there it goes again. So I'm excited about those folks getting their hands on this project and being able to ask those questions. But I wondered for you, like, if you're thinking about those folks and you're thinking about helping them to like think about those connections, what are there any stories or anecdotes that you could share around how this shows up. You know, like what were those moments for you where you were like, okay, here's some, all these check boxes. This is a clear diagnosis according to this model, but you heard something else that made you go, but I wonder if, like, do you have one or two of those that could kind of pop the door open for people listening?
Well, yes, some of it has to go back to like what I mentioned earlier. There was a period of time that I did a lot of research and did a lot of speaking on the sibling experience in families where there's a child with a mental illness. And there's not a lot out there. So like I read through all the research that that was available at the time. And I found these little things that were making me think of clients I was seeing, like in my more in my private practice. And at that time, most of my private practice was, my referral base was from eating disorder treatment centers or hospitals. I saw a lot of eating disorders. That was like the diagnosis that walked in the room, and very real, very, very real. But as I started thinking about all these different stories, because there is a little bit of a profile I would see, like really high achieving, really great grades, really kind of compliant, didn't really want to get in trouble, a lot of anxiety. There was like this little profile. I'm like, this is weird and kind of interesting. So I started my current patients and then patients I no longer saw. I started looking for what was like sibling relationships. And what I found in almost every single case was that there was another member of the family who was ill, like a mental illness, some kind of addiction, something really like really significant in the family system. And like most of the attention would go over there. And then, but I'm over here seeing this sibling. And it started opening my eyes to the idea of, oh, like these eating disorders and all these people I see with like GI problems and stomach complaints and issues with food and all this anxiety. What if this is like a manifestation of something else? And as, you know, I started peeling this apart with clients and again, like, and then even going back and looking at like my old charts, I'm like, oh my gosh, this eating disorder did not just like show up. This is a manifestation of something that bigger that's happening in the rest of the family. And then, so my treatment approach at that time started shifting a little bit to looking at, like you were saying about the chiropractor, like what's going on that you're being pulled apart and it's showing up in the body, right? Well, what's going on with these individuals who are like having all this GI distress and all these fears around food and all these things? It really was like when we got down to the real issue, it was usually some kind of like a relational attachment trauma, right? That, you know, not getting what they needed, not being seen as important. I mean, all these different things. I don't want to rock the boat. My parents are already underwater dealing with my brother. So I'm going to be over here and get straight A's and not ever ask for anything. But there was all this suppression of like, you're not supposed to talk about it. So the other thing that started showing up during this time was like the role of secrets and like the suppression of truth in the service of, well, you know, we don't want anyone to judge your brother, or, you know, don't talk about that because then people are going to think weird things about our family. Or, oh, if you say this thing, you know, people might not want to be your friend or whatever. But the suppression of truth or the hiding of truth in the service of looking good or accepted or acceptable on the outside, I'm like, oh my gosh, that's what it is. In every single one of these cases, every single patient, every former patient, I found it either together with the client or reviewing my records. There was a suppression of truth that ended up being the impetus for the symptoms. So that's what got me started on like that whole thing. And then it was, you know, kind of lined up with my work at the facility, which was these, all these folks coming in with a laundry list of diagnoses and charts that are this thick and that say all kinds of words and things. And I'm like, what if it's not any of this? These are all symptoms. They're real. They're not, these are not fake symptoms. These are real experiences. But what if the source is not what we think it is? What if it's something else? And then all that did is just exploded open in terms of finding what is that other thing? Mm-hmm. What's something else? And so often it was usually a secret or a suppressed truth.
And then when that gets revealed to the patient, to the family system, then what happens?
I mean, most of the time is that's where you see the accelerated healing. I mean, I had folks who like came in with the most severe eating disorders who had all this treatment, nothing really changed. They're always regressing. And then like, they're okay. I mean, it wasn't like overnight, you know, there was a process, but once we found the thing and like brought it to light where we could talk about it openly, not through shame, not through judgment, it's like, that's when people started getting better. Now, granted, over the years, there were a couple times, including getting myself fired by exposing a truth or a held secret that the system was like, they were not ready to go there yet. And that felt, you know, I think for those folks felt very overwhelming, very threatening, and not going to do it. Some of those people actually came back later. But, you know, so you also, you know, not everyone's ready at the same time. You kind of have to like sometimes tiptoe in there. But that has largely been my experience, both working with really complex psychiatric disorders all the way through to my private practice, that suppression of truth, suppression of authenticity in the service of, this is how I really feel, but I'm not going to let anyone know that because I don't want to be judged or they won't like me, or right. This disconnect between truth and authenticity and then what is going on the outside world. That is the thing that gives rise to symptoms, is what I found in my experience. The challenge is getting people to look there, because sometimes the truth, the thing that's been suppressed, the thing that's been hidden may not be very pretty.
Yeah. Or even known, right? I mean, I imagine they're, I mean, it's a secret, right? Like at some point in the family, in the generational system, maybe the thing just kind of disappears out of everyone's consciousness, but it's still held somewhere in the body, in the mind, in the spirit, you know, like, I don't know exactly in the DNA. How would you say that?
Well, you know, the book that you and I have talked about, this, It Didn't Start With You, mm-hmm. this book by Mark Wolin, this is the book to read if you're interested in this notion of inheritance of things that you might not even know about, right? That have existed or happened in previous, like either with your parents, grandparents, you know, other layers. But I think he just does such a phenomenal job explaining this, literally this like inheritance that happens and you carry around with you pieces of that there might not even be a knowledge of, but it's been passed down. So like we were saying earlier, like, I mean, traditions get passed down through families all the time, or belief sets, even vernacular. I mean, like there's things that get kind of passed down. Well, why not memory? Why not secrets? And if we can be open to the possibility of those things, it just opens a bunch of doors. I mean, who knows what you're going to find? You might not find anything, but you probably will. Right? You ask enough questions and then it kind of opens up these, and he does a lot of case examples in this book of people he's worked with who came in with this kind of like symptom or this set of symptoms that just didn't really seem to make a lot of sense. They've been to all the doctors, taken all the meds. And then he does like this kind of, well, let's talk about your family and different things, a genogram, like a family tree. Mm-hmm. They find it. Like, oh, that's what this is.
There it is.
And then there's this like, I mean, in his work, sometimes it was almost an instant alleviation of the symptoms. Sometimes it still, you know, it took a while to work that out of the system, but you're not running around carrying something that actually didn't start with you. So it's fascinating.
But I think that's one of the things I really loved about your book was that aspect that of the generational healing and that thinking outside of the box, because I like to think that I'm pretty good at doing that, about thinking outside the box most of the time. But it was your book inspired me in so many different ways of things that are going on for me and in my life that maybe I need to check under this rock. I need to look at this from a different angle. And just watching this family and knowing that, okay, yes, it's a fictitional family, but the history and or legend, whichever we're going to call it, that is weaved through that gave me insights on, oh my goodness, maybe I need to look here, or maybe I need to check this out. So I think you've done a great job with that intergenerational process of where seeing, helping us to see where some of those pieces could have come from, and maybe other different avenues and ways to look at things. So I really love that about your book.
Thank you. You know, and that is one of the things, like that was not part of the original idea and inspiration at all. That showed up through the writing. And it's a pretty significant element in the book, right? The intergenerational transmission. I didn't start there. That one just kind of showed up as the story unfolded. But I think those scenes in particular, where there's the discovery and acknowledgement of things from the past that like, oh my God, I had no idea this was like playing out in my present. My guess, or maybe it's my hope, is that those will be the scenes that I think lots of people will resonate with, even if you're not in the field, diagnosed, not diagnosed, whatever. But this sense of like, oh my gosh, now this makes so much sense when I think about it like this.
Yeah. And you do such a great job of giving so many ways of getting at it, you know, through the storytelling. I can't imagine someone who wouldn't be able to identify with hearing someone else's voice in your head of like, oh God, that reminds me of, you know, like if you stop thinking that it's your voice and go, whose might that be? Or even symptomology associated, you know, physical body, sensory things that are going on as a result of this thing that is just completely hidden.
You know, that reminds me, I have a client that I see right now. I've been seeing her for years. A lot of anxiety, a lot of, even panic at times, and kind of an extreme fear of being judged, making a mistake, these kind of things, right? And so we've been working on this pretty diligently on and off, using different ways. Well, not that long ago, within the last few months, she would be telling me, she's like, well, this thing happened over the weekend, and she would refer to herself in using her last name. And finally, one point, I'm like, you know, sometimes when you're recounting a particularly difficult experience that you had, you talk about yourself like almost in the third person using your last name. And she's like, I do? I'm like, yeah. And I said, what is that? Like, and she found it. She was like, oh my God. Like one of her relatives, not in her immediate, the generation, but the one above, would call the kids by their last names when they were like in trouble. And so we just started like following that thread a little bit. And then her experience is exactly like what you just said, Amanda, is once she's like, you know, now that I really am thinking about it, when that voice is kind of like in my head, it actually doesn't even sound like my voice. It's like their voice is like talking in my head. So then, you know, then we've been going down this path of things that she's internalized, which we all do this. But this one is a really shaming, kind of chastising, mean voice that kind of almost calls her names. Mm. But she's always thought of that as her. That's who I am. That's like how I talk to myself. And so now that we've finally got to this, like, actually, it isn't. It's already shifting for her in like really massive ways. But it took finding that. And the clue was she was talking in like in this way that just didn't feel like her.
Right? Mm-hmm. I've heard people do that even either the words sound completely not theirs. Like, you know, there's this just their normal natural tone. And then all of a sudden you hear, or like a pitch change, a dramatic pitch change always makes me go,
What happened this morning? I was in a group supervision with some clinicians, and it was a very light conversation, but everyone was kind of talking about just, I don't want to overstep. I don't want to like get out of my lane. Just this kind of, there's a bunch of new staff and they're all trying to feel their way. One of the women goes, yeah, I have things I want to say. I want to be assertive, but I'm so afraid that if I say the wrong thing, man, I'm going to get a talking to. She did just like this. And I was like, oh, a talking to? And she goes, yeah. I said, well, you didn't just say a talking to. You said, I'm going to get a talking to. She sounded like an angry parent talking to a child. So I said, has that ever happened to you at work? And then, I mean, she knew it right then. She's like, nope, but I know where that comes from. But how easy, right? That she brings this sense of herself into spaces and scares. I mean, really, she was scaring herself. I don't want to be assertive. I don't want to say the wrong thing because I'm going to get in trouble and somebody's going to come give me a talking to. That has nothing to do with anything. Like, it has nothing to do with the employment space, her job, probably even her. Because she said, you know, because I've actually like never had that happen to me at work. I've literally never had a boss come and say, like, you're in trouble. You're like too assertive. She's like, oh, I know exactly who this is from. So there, I'm like, all right, well, when I see you next week, let's have more conversation about this. Right? Something so, I mean, it's not simple. It's not innocent, but profound in terms of how she experiences herself even at work.
Yeah.
Right. So just one little catch, right? Like of a phrase, a tone, or like something that just seems a little bit like doesn't fit with what's happening right now can open the door versus just keep playing that forward and perpetually keep herself in a state of feeling like afraid to speak her mind.
Yeah.
So interesting.
Well, we have a few readers. Do you all have any questions for Carlin or anything that you want to share about the book that we've missed in our conversation?
I was just thinking about how along those lines of, I don't know, one of the things I love that you did in the book is every time I felt like I started to figure out what was happening, it was like another little mystery bomb just kept happening and I had to follow it. And can you guys hear me okay? I'm kind of glitching over here.
Yeah.
Can you hear me? Okay. So I really loved that. But what I really loved with the therapeutic aspect of it was like their job was just to continue to show up. And they didn't have to understand everything that was happening or put all the puzzle pieces together. It was just this constant, like, just keep coming. We'll see you next week. Just keep showing up and just keep calling. And I find that I found comfort in that, because every time I'm puzzled by something, it's like all I have to do is show up. And kind of how you said, when those things come up and when those puzzle pieces come up, they just need to be witnessed. They just need that sort of acknowledgement. And you hope that someday it'll all make sense. But
yeah, a little bit of leap of faith, right? That like, okay, I literally don't even know what you're talking about right now, but I'll see you next week. See what happens. But that it's it really is an unfolding.
Mm-hmm.
I have had experiences where it's been a like instant epiphany, aha moment, and then like things shift dramatically right then and there. Usually it's a little bit more of an unpacking.
Yeah.
But either way, like show up, don't give up. I know it doesn't feel good, but we're going to get there. We'll get there. That's great. Thank you, Alyssa.
And I loved how the family worked together. You know, there wasn't a lot of finger pointing and not helping. It was very supportive. It was very, you know, and I think in traditional families, a lot of times there's, like you said earlier, some of the kids or some person gets left out of it because they're trying to help this person. Mm-hmm. And I loved how they all worked together to resolve, you know, the situation and to come up with answers for not just one person, but for the family. Right. And I love how all that was weaved together.
Thank you, Lori.
I have a question, because we've been talking about kind of like the easy unfoldment of the story and kind of the strings that kind of were magnetic and they wanted to attach themselves and spin this awesome web. But I was wondering if there are any moments where it wasn't so easy and that web became hard for you. Okay, so, but yes. And what were those? And like, was there something? Was there something underneath those moments, those lulls of creativity and bring pieces into the book that you wanted to bring in? Like, why was that happening?
I mean, I had lots of moments, you know, through this entire process where I would just be like stuck and like irritated, you know, like it's like, why all of a sudden do I have like no thoughts? And I can't come up with a single word. And I'm like looking through the thesaurus to try and find a word that might fit. I mean, like this kind of stuckness and, you know, having some, a couple of pretty significant moments through the writing of this book of having my own epiphany or my own like, oh my gosh, I had no idea. This was at play behind the scenes. Like one of the, and I think we might've talked about it in the last podcast, Amanda, like I was trying to write what I thought was going to be like a really easy and kind of like fun-ish scene. And I just nothing was coming to me. And Amanda said, well, why don't you just press pause on that and just go work on something else, work on something easier, just see what happens. Well, I end up in like one day turning out this like excruciating scene in the book. I had like a stomach ache while I was writing it. I had a headache. I didn't feel good. It was so weird. But, you know, going home, and then I did some digging and made some connections and realized I was kind of like channeling something that I didn't like. It's like channeling something that I didn't know I knew, as odd as that might sound. It was like a knowledge that I was feeling and was somehow trying to like get itself into my consciousness, but it felt super like, I don't even know what this is. And then go home and learn some things about, you know, some things that had been going on in the family, and then asking a bunch of questions and calling some relatives. And I'm like, oh, look at that fun little nugget, right? It's like somewhere in my deep consciousness, I knew, I just didn't know it in my brain. So as those two things got linked up, it was like, oh, like I, then the writing, it's like it resumed and I was just churning out the chapters. So there were definitely many, many times when I was stuck and just couldn't get my act together. But I think it's something was emerging inside that really needed to be kind of seen or recognized or just acknowledged. And once that happened, then it's almost like it opened the passages, and then I went right back into writing. Yeah, there were lots of times that happened.
That was the big one, though. I remember being like, why did she choose that chapter? I was really hoping that she was going to choose like a beautiful, mysterious one.
Yeah.
You're like sweating. And
I know, I remember I was like sweating, like, I don't know what's happening to me right now.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But it was the channeling of something else. Like it would have been easy. And I think at this point I knew enough, but like, it would have been easy to be like, oh, you know what? Maybe I just ate something that didn't agree with me. That's why my stomach hurt. Well, we're at altitude.
Elevation. Elevation sickness. Yeah.
But there were other things happening. Like you were having nightmares too. Yeah. Remember? Yeah. And I was like, could these be? And you were like, nope.
Oh, I just, I'm just not at home. Yeah, right. But like, it's easy. We all do this.
Yes, totally.
I'm just out of my element. I miss my own bed. I'm the elevation. Maybe I ate something weird. Maybe I haven't had enough water today. Like, okay. And it doesn't mean that at times those all wouldn't be totally reasonable explanations. But what if it isn't? What if it isn't that I ate something weird?
What if 2 weeks later you realize?
2 weeks later, I learned about all this stuff. And I was like, oh, there it is. Right. But that, I think that's like part of my overreaching or overarching hope for this book, is that it supports and introduces and encourages this idea of like, okay, it might be. It literally might be elevation sickness. And what if there's something else in there that we just haven't found yet? And and maybe you won't find anything. That's okay. And it's just elevation sickness. That's it. That's going to be what it is going to be sometimes. But the idea of not just stopping at that first interpretation, but digging a little bit.
I love that you say and, because my first thing is to go but instead of and.
Yeah. Because the thing is, it could be that. Like, I mean, I've in all these years, like sometimes I have worked with clients at, really kind of high level of care facilities. And, sometimes they're really, really sick. Sometimes. Now, it doesn't mean that when they're in a little bit better state, then we can go, let's peel it back a little bit and see if something else is going on. But sometimes someone's just really symptomatic. And there isn't this like hidden under the rock explanation, but can we be willing to look at that? Right. Even if we just don't find anything this time around, you know what? You have elevation sickness. That's all you got. Okay. Drink some fluids, take some Tylenol, and you'll be okay in a couple of days. Sometimes that's just all it's going to be, but can we be open to the possibility that there might be something else in there that addressing it, witnessing it, will resolve not just this headache, but all the other headaches that you seem to get. Okay. That, like, just whether we find something, we'll figure it out. But let's not close down the possibility, right? That's really
you're talking about symptoms and rocks and what's under them, and I'm having a freaking coughing attack over here.
Of course, the classic therapist would be like, well, Alyssa, how are you feeling? Never mind, I'm not so that.
So one of the things that I want to know, I mean, this has been amazing, and I hope people are excited to put all of the pieces together for themselves and go on this journey with this family that really is facing a true crisis that brought to the regular, a typical traditional mental health system might take one pathway. And because there are a few people who look under the rock and ask the questions, and wonder if there might be something else going on, this family gets to a place where there's some resolution, where symptoms dissipate, where even more gets revealed. And so I'm really excited about it. But one of the things that I've always wondered is like, what, and I don't know why I didn't ask these questions as we were going. I guess maybe I had intuitive thoughts about it, but like, who were your favorite characters to write and who were the hard ones?
Yeah, my favorite characters to write are the ones who I think embody a confidence and like just kind of a deep knowing, a wisdom, like something that feels just kind of unquestioned. And I think those characters typically in the book probably show up as a little bit more spiritually connected, and open. Like those are the characters that were like, sure, okay, could be that, could be this. Oh, look over there. Maybe it's that. Like a little bit more curious and not so quick to shut down and stifle, really, kind of stifle the exploration or the possibility. The characters that I would say that, like, one of the main characters was my most difficult. And I think it was it's the character who's the most split in terms of, on the outside, this is what I see and what I think, but on the inside, this totally different thing is going on. And it's very fragmented, like very fractured. And it got easier to write her and write about her as she was becoming a little bit more integrated. Yeah. But that really split apart experience was hard. And I think why it was hard is because, like, I mean, I get that. Like, I think about times in my life where I was really fractured and kind of living this way, but feeling this way, and they were not aligned. So, I mean, it was same thing, probably, you know, even just writing about this fictional character was, you know, I bringing up my own experiences and memories of times in my life where I felt very disconnected and not congruent with myself. And like, not really sure why that was even happening.
Yeah, that element of unconsciousness where it's kind of like you have to pretend to be in the dark of not knowing, you know, this is what's happening. This is, you know, you have to write it like from inside of the character. So you only know so much and it's painful.
And scary. Mm-hmm. I have that experience. All, I mean, like really regularly with the people I work with is they can, you know, even get to the idea of like, okay, I get that there might be something here that I'm not seeing or that I'm just not like in touch with yet, but it scares me. What is it? I mean, what if I don't want to see what that thing is? What if I don't want to face it? I mean, that's a real thing.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and I think the probably my favorite characters are also the ones that really are kind of a blend of like people from my own life who've had a big impact on me and the way I think and my own philosophies. Like there's like bits and pieces of all these different people inside these characters. So the ones that, like, I think about like my favorite ones to write about were the ones that hold a lot of those pieces of other people.
Love it.
Man, I'm so tempted to ask about all your research behind choosing the names, just because I know we've touched on that before.
We'll have to keep that in the post interview.
Yeah, because you're right, Alyssa.
We'll come back to it.
There was a lot.
And now we're on it, I know.
these were not randomly chosen for the most part. Yeah.
Well, it's been an amazing journey to witness and be part of, and I'm so excited to see it get into the hands of the people who are looking for another answer, who have just, even if it's just a splinter, a shred of hope, that this book can be the thing that buoys them to the next possibility. So thank you for all the hard work bringing it to the world. Teddy?
We want to know the name of the book. What are we looking for?
The name of the book is Feathers from the Fire, and it will be arriving on Monday, March 20th, which is also the spring equinox.
Very important.
And very important day. Mm-hmm.
And how will they know that? By reading the book.
Reading the book. Yes.
That's fun. All right. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you
for this opportunity. And thanks to our listeners for tuning in and turning over those rocks. Mm-hmm. Go turn them over. Don't settle for the easy, quick answers. Yes. There might be something much more important hiding there. So thanks for being with us today. And we'll be all over social media on March 20th. Mm-hmm. I don't know why. I always see the numbers. And then anyway. March 20th. Grab your copy that day.
It's a palindrome.
It's a palindrome. It's a magical day. I can't wait to see what happens.
3202023.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Another special day.
It's so magical that I mess it up every time I try to get near it.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody.
Yeah. All right. Till next time.
All right. Next time.